TheSyncBook.com is nearing the end of a massive upgrade, which means that so much cool stuff is coming, but it also means that access to parts of the website will be restricted from January 15th to January 28th. It also means that we need your help during this time, and want to give you really neat stuff as a thank you. Everyone who registers at thesyncbook.com/beta will receive an exclusive sample chapter from Marty Weeds' forthcoming book, and an exclusive video clip from the Olympia Sync Summit. Everyone. And for a limited number of you willing to get your hands dirty in a digital sort of way, there's something extra special we're giving away. A book that people have spent years waiting and asking us for. If your beta tester application is accepted, remember there's only a limited number of positions available, we will give you nearly the entire 2012 draft of Suicide Kings. Please visit thesyncbook.com/beta right away. Even with non-linear phenomena, time is of the essence.
You are tuned into Pentimental with hosts John and Tom McGuire. Pentimental is a dialogue-based show that elucidates the intersections between synchronicity, science, culture, and psychonautics. Through the medium of open-minded dialogue, we explore the possibility that the only way out is in. www.thesyncbook.com/radio.
This is John McGuire, and you are listening to Pentimental on Syncbook Radio. Today, for episode number 5, we have joining us for a one-on-one conversation, physicist and alternative researcher Matt Pulver of BlueScience.org, as well as a trilogue with professional engineer and author of The Giza Power Plant, Christopher Dunn. The unifying theme for this episode is undoubtedly pyramids, with a focus on how they were constructed and how they might function in a physical science sense. To balance out the speculation on pyramid power, in part 1, Matt Pulver outlines a very rigorous school of nonlinear physics called subquantum kinetics, the brainchild of Dr. Paul LaViolette, who Matt has worked with on peer-reviewed material and done computer modeling for. As always, I selected these particular guests, hoping they would sync up unconsciously or resonate in some meaningful way. It was a lot of fun as usual, and I hope you all enjoy it. Thanks again. Joining us today on Pentimental is Matt Pulver. Matt is a physicist. He's a conscious researcher, computer scientist. He's been on Always Record in the past, talking mostly about his 2001 A False Flag Odyssey theory. So Matt wears a lot of hats, but today maybe we'll try to keep the focus a bit more on the nature of physics and consciousness instead of conspiracy, but we'll kind of go wherever you want to go, Matt. So thanks again for being with me today. And yeah, thanks for being on.
Well, thank you, John. It's always a pleasure to speak to you.
So again, I just gave a really brief introduction, but again, why don't you tell us just a bit about where you come from and all that stuff?
Studied math physics in college, saw the compartmentalization that takes place in academia. I felt that this really wasn't for me, so I head out. This is during the dot-com boom, so I switched careers into computer programming. That's kind of what I'm still doing right now, and that's I feel like that has actually been funding my alternative research into physics. As you know, I've been working with Dr. Paul LaViolette. I've been finding his work to be particularly interesting on multiple levels. He does have a very scientific framework. He's made a number of very falsifiable predictions on things, and it's been supported by evidence that we found, namely in the ice core samples to support his superwave theory, that we have these periodic superwaves that come through the galaxy, that our galaxy goes through occasional active and inactive states, where we've been in a long period of an inactive state right now. And when the galaxy is in an active state, it has very, I guess you might say, intense effects upon the sun, which in turn has effects upon the Earth. Then this is what we find evidence for. And this all sprouts from a more fundamental theory of his called subquantum kinetics, which we'll get into. But this is just to, I guess, answer your question as far as my background. These are the kinds of things that I've been researching, and we've just, I guess in 2013, we did have a paper that I've worked on with him published in International Journal of General Systems.
Maybe why don't we give people a clear idea of what we're talking about in terms of Paul's work. So he has developed a theoretical framework called subquantum kinetics, and it's largely inspired by a general systems approach to physics, which is, you could say, it's opposed to the reductionist paradigm, where we're starting from the bottom up and general systems is almost starting from the top down and piecing together the pieces that way. And he sees physics in a much more, you could say, organic way. So in a sense, we're tying or tethering biology and physics once again with this sort of nonlinear dynamic perspective on how microphysics works. And also, like you mentioned, these galactic core explosions, as above, so below, you see very similar stuff acting on the macrocosm as well. So it's not easy to summarize what subquantum kinetics is, but it is a physics of the ether. So why don't we start there, and maybe you can give us just a general idea of how you see it and how to best explain it to people just being introduced to it.
Yeah. So as you said, it's a systems approach. So maybe I'll just start with explaining what is systems theory and how that has, it's actually been applied to many sciences, and how it seems like Paul Laviolette is, as far as I know, the first to apply it to fundamental physics. So just to maybe start with an example of systems theory, you can take like an ecological system where you have a population of, say, wolves and rabbits. They interact. So if we just look at the feeding, rabbits feed on plants, wolves feed on the rabbits, among other things, but let's just focus on that particular relationship. And then there's also the seasons and the environment. So as you can see, we're already dealing with open systems. We identify these subsystems, but we can already see that there is an interdependent relationship between the two and externalities. So from the get-go, we don't look at isolated systems. We acknowledge that everything that we're looking at, I mean, science in general, for the most part, we're looking at some aspect of the universe, but it's never isolated. And to think that it's isolated is to make a false assumption on the very first step. So systems theory embraces that idea in its foundations, that we're dealing with those open systems. So let's analyze systems taking this into consideration. So it's not all qualitative in the sense. It immediately gets quantitative when we can write the relationship. So say the wolves have a certain rate, depending on the size of the population, then will affect the population of the rabbits in a certain way. So the more wolves that there are, the more that it's going to reduce the rabbit population. And likewise, there's a feedback effect, because when the rabbit population is less, then it's going to affect the wolf population, because then they're not going to have as much food, at least in that particular aspect. And so this can be written out in the form of differential equations. So I guess without going into necessarily the form, but we have these rigorous mathematical models, which then, when we solve it, give rise to the phenomenon that we actually observe in nature. It matches what we see in nature, such as these cycles that naturally occur. So when the wolf population increases, that's going to decrease the rabbit population. But then that, as the rabbit population gets low, as I mentioned, that's going to reduce the size of the wolf population, which then gives an opportunity for the rabbit population to rise again. So you can get a sense for these cycles, and thereby we get this kind of structure already. So we deal with open systems, and we can make verifiable and useful predictions. So this kind of thinking has permeated generally most, if not all, sciences, except for one, and that has been fundamental physics. So fundamental physics, even up and through the 90s and 2000s, still looks at individual particles as somehow these perfect little mathematical systems. Like an electron is just somehow forever spinning and has, you know, a certain charge and such, that it just looks at the world as a perfect, you might say, billiard ball table. I mean, that's more Newtonian, but the idea still carries over even into string theory. It's like, okay, then we're dealing with these perfect little strings that have these little properties. At its heart, it's still reductionist, you might say. So the thinking that Paul added to this, and maybe it's worth mentioning his particular background. Both of his parents worked in the Manhattan Project. And this was the code name for the project that built the atomic bombs that were used in World War II on Japan. So to analyze these nuclear reactions, the nuclear reactions themselves are a series of kinetic equations that are very similar in form to the systems theory. So like if you have certain isotope of uranium will maybe decay into other types of isotopes. And these are represented in differential equations in the same kind of way that the wolf and the rabbit equations are. And so from a young age, he was already very much involved with this type of thinking because he would have a lot of conversations with his father on physics. Having built up this intuition, he was in a position to then apply this to fundamental physics. So he is a proponent of the ether. Actually, a different angle on this is let's ask the question, what is really a fundamental particle? We have like an electron that has like a handful of properties. It has mass, it has charge, it has something called a spin. But what is maintaining it? Like, why does it have this particular structure? And why do protons have a particular structure? And why do all protons have the identical same structure as each other? Same with electrons. This is something that's peculiar about every fundamental particle. There's only a relatively small number of fundamental particles, but they're all identical to each other. You know, why aren't they like organic organisms where every, you know, there's many cats, but every cat is different in some way. They're not all exactly the same, but it seems as far as we can tell that every species of fundamental particle is exactly the same. And why is this? So he applied systems theory to looking at fundamental particles and looked at a particle itself as a system. And there are these reactions that were noticed in chemistry. One example is, you know the name actually better than I do, the BZ.
Belousov-Zubinsky.
Okay, thank you. It's this chemical reaction. It's a slow chemical reaction where at any given point in space, you'll have a certain chemical transform into another chemical that then transforms back into the original chemical. And this is ordered in such a way so that you get these macroscopic patterns. Like, for instance, you might get like a spiral that slowly moves. It might take like a full minute, for example, to do a full rotation. And so it looks like the chemicals are actually moving, but it's the actual reaction. It's the chemicals are more or less staying in place, but it's the reaction that makes it look like movement. Like an example would be, if you're at like a sports stadium and people are doing the wave, right? It looks like you have this wave going around the stadium, but no one is actually running with the wave. It's just one person standing up, and then that's triggering the next person next to them to stand up. It's the pattern that moves. It's not the individual component. Mm-hmm. So he applied this thinking to, well, first he considered the idea that there isn't ether. And any mainstream physicist will kind of, these days, will just laugh at the idea and say that, you know, in 1905, Einstein had proven this wrong with his special and general theory of relativity. But this idea was never fully stamped out. Scientists have always continued to investigate it and actually find support for it. And my own opinion is that there is a lot of very good evidence for the ether. And I know you have you've done a lot of research on that yourself, John, and can support the idea, but it's still ostracized. It's still, you know, seen as pseudoscience within mainstream physics right now.
Well, when Einstein came in, he said, well, everything's relative and space is defined by the objects themselves. So there is really no absolute space or absolute ether. But at the same time, to me, that never distinguished the idea of space. It just changed the character of it. So yes, it is relational. Everything defines itself in relation to something else, and space is this dynamic, fluctuating manifold. For sure, Einstein is on point there. I just don't see why people take it so far to say, oh, there's nothing. There's nothing besides objects. Einstein, I feel like, actually brought a systems approach to viewing space-time. Mm. Everything's connected. Everything influences everything else. But at the same time, if you want to take it to the extreme, you can just be like, everything is defined mathematically in these equations by the objects, so there is no space. And so it becomes almost a philosophy instead of actual hard science. So it's still a debate going on, especially in string theory, where string theorists are saying that there is absolute space. You read Brian Greene's books, who's the biggest proponent of string theory, and that's the argument he's making. His book, The Fabric of the Cosmos, is all about relative space versus absolute space and who's right and who's wrong. And Lee Smolin, who wrote The Trouble with Physics, he's a relativist, and he's saying all these string theorists are going back to absolute space and they're wrong. And the string theorists are saying Lee Smolin is wrong. So there's this debate going on. And so the idea that we would scoff at the idea of absolute space or ether, whatever you want to call it, it's just we scoff at labels, but we're not really addressing the thing in and of itself.
Yeah. So Laviolette considered, okay, well, what if there's more than one ether? And so well, for those not familiar with the concept, one can consider an ether to be, say, similar to like a highly permeable gas or a liquid or some kind of substance that just fills all of space, which is very subtle. And unlike, say, water or any kind of gas that's made of molecules, an ether is actually a much more simpler substance. It is, you might say, truly continuous. It doesn't have things like mass or charge or spin or any of these things that there's only two things that they do. They react with each other to perhaps form other ethers, or they diffuse, meaning that if you get a clump of it, like if you get one region of space that's dense, more dense than its surroundings, then it will naturally diffuse and become uniform.
Right. In the same way a circuit works, if you build up a bunch of charge and then you let it flow, I mean, it's the same thing. It's called a potential. So for anyone unfamiliar with the concept, it's a very fundamental thing in physics where if you clump together a bunch of potential, it's going to flow downhill.
Yeah. Or if you, even if you just take water and you spill it out of a cup onto a table, right? It's not all just going to stay in one space. It's going to diffuse outward. So it's something, it would actually be more unusual if it didn't diffuse. So the fact that it diffuses is actually a very natural kind of thing to take into consideration. So because these things react and they diffuse, and these are more or less the only two things that characterize these substances, these types of systems are called reaction diffusion systems, unsurprisingly. And so this kind of framework has been, or this, the mathematical treatment of these types of systems has been well researched by chemists, for instance, because chemistry involves a lot of reaction diffusion systems at the molecular level, but he's just taking this idea and applying it to the etheric level. So what this gives rise to then is what are called solitons. So he's found that if you take three substances and have them react in a particular way, he's actually basing this off of some research that was done on a system called the Brusselator. The Brusselator just happened to be a particular reaction diffusion system that has been studied since at least the 70s. And investigated what happens when you apply this to the ether and found that you can actually form solitons, which are stable clumps of like stable patterns that are basically a particle.
But it's more of a process, right? It's constantly a fluctuating thing. It's almost like a human being where we're constantly taking in new constituents and renewing our bodies in the same way we could think of a particle doing that. It's not just the fundamental particle is taking in its environment and renewing itself consistently. Is that kind of a good way to view the soliton?
Yeah, that's correct. Because it's constantly undergoing these reactions. In fact, it's the constant interaction between the reaction and the diffusion that these are both continuously happening that actually is able to have it form a stable particle. And I would say that concept in itself is unfamiliar to many physicists. I would speculate if they knew about this, that many more would be jumping on board as I did and seeing the significance of this. And historically, you know, I had a physics professor that had always asked me like, okay, if you have an idea, why hasn't this been explored before? I mean, the ideas are, you might say, a dime a dozen, but why hasn't this been investigated in the past? And the answer, there is actually a very good answer for this, is that these are highly nonlinear systems and we didn't have the computational power back in the 1930s to do this. And there was a seminal paper by Alan Turing, and he's generally known for being one of the grandfathers of computer science, but he had a paper sometime around 1950, plus or minus a couple of years, called On the Morphology of Biological Systems, where he took this idea of the reaction diffusion system and applied it to biology. So it hasn't been that well known, is the answer to that question. So it simply wasn't available to the forefathers of quantum mechanics back in the early 1900s to the 1930s, while quantum mechanics was taking its present form. So it simply wasn't available, but it's available now. And even Laviolette, he had a highly developed intuition on this, you know, more so than myself or anyone that I was aware of. So he could see that the soliton was forming, but he wasn't able to prove it mathematically or do it on a computer. And that's actually that was my contribution to this, of actually proving that his idea on this was correct, and that was the main point of the paper from that was in 2013. So it's a type of unification, it's the same type of unification that is motivating physics, even string theory, because the whole idea of unification and, you know, you might say the goal of physics is to find the simplicity within the complexity, right? Is to find the essential principles that then give rise to the complexity that we see in the world. And that's precisely what this does here, because a reaction diffusion system is far simpler. It's a very simple kind of system that makes very reasonable assumptions or axioms in it. And this is what actually then gives rise to things like notions of mass and charge and spin, which we actually is kind of in the works because it requires three dimensions. So I wouldn't say that we've gotten to that point yet, but it also explains why all particles are the same. The particular size of these solitons are all the same. So it's kind of this epiphenomenal quality, you might say, or characteristic of these solitons from these more fundamental principles.
You know, I want to stress that the paper that you and Paul produced, again, this is like not pseudoscience. This is peer-reviewed stuff that is well-documented, is been computer modeled. And for anyone that has the expertise to look into it, I think they would be very surprised to find just how rigorous it is. And I think that subquantum kinetics is in the same tradition as, say, someone like David Bohm in the implicate order, or Alfred North Whitehead and his idea of process physics, or Ilya Prigogine and his concept of order out of chaos. But anyway, yeah, they were, I guess, Paul's forerunners, but then he really picked up their ideas and synthesized them in a way that really tries to answer those fundamental questions of where does spin come from? Why are all these particles seem to be the same? Why do they have these inherent properties? We just say they're inherent. Don't question it because there is no way to answer it. That's the reductionist approach is we have our string. We have our whatever, our Higgs boson. That's the only thing we need. We have our little billiard ball or our fundamental string, and we can attach whatever meaning we want to that and then create whatever we want from that. But when you look into the mainstream physics world, it's nothing but confusion nowadays, especially string theory that is resorting to all kinds of esotericism to explain this and that. And not that esotericism is bad, but when you try to pass it off as whatever, objective science or something, it becomes largely disingenuous and kind of fraudulent. So I see string theory as kind of fraudulent. But anyway, this is not out of the blue, this type of perspective on physics. It's never been, I'd say, this well developed in this type of way. But there is a tradition for this, and it's a very well-documented school of thought. And not only that, but I think one of the problems here is that Paul's work might be a little controversial because then he takes the extra step. He takes the brave extra step, and he says, like Velikovsky, for example, of Worlds in Collision, he would make ties between ancient myth and these ancient peoples that seem to have some insight into this creation physics, largely through symbolic means, not through mathematics, but through the stories they're telling and the archetypes that are being expressed in these stories. Paul makes these connections between, say, the tarot and Hinduism and between subquantum kinetics. And so I guess in one sense, if you want to be accepted in the mainstream, you're kind of shooting yourself in the foot that way. But at the same time, it's also the more honest thing to do. And another person that does that is Don DeGracia, who I just had on, and he again, ties nonlinear dynamics with yoga and the idea of the gunas, which are these dynamic patterns of consciousness, and that consciousness could actually be a physical substance of sorts that's coursing through us. And in that way, consciousness is a pattern in space-time, in the same way that Paul is saying a particle is a pattern in space-time. It's just a process. It's not an absolute thing. There are no such things as absolutes. So really, I guess for the reductionist that wants all these clean-cut answers, this idea of a process-driven physics is uncomfortable, not only for practical reasons, because again, it's hard to model, but also for these philosophical and almost prejudicial reasons where we'll look back on ancient peoples and say, oh, they didn't know what the hell they were talking about. Look how superstitious they were. But the truth is they're just couching these very fundamental processes in symbolism that we don't understand. So really, we're attacking someone else for our own stupidity. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
I like to think that Paul's effort in trying to connect all those things is a good thing and the way we need to go, but it's also, I don't know if it's the way to mainstream acceptance. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but I don't know what he should be doing differently. I mean, to take an example, he published a paper on how the Big Bang never happened. And so, of course, that's going to raise a lot of red lights.
Yeah.
But so it took him actually 8 years to finally get it published, because the people who are doing the peer reviews are it's someone who has time to do it. Let me put it that way. And especially if Paul's not too well known within the astrophysics community. I think he is now, but before that paper, where I guess where I'm going with this is that once he finally did get it published, and then it was, you know, seen by other astrophysicists that are, you might say, higher up in the hierarchy, he did receive a lot of accolades from people because it's good research. I mean, it essentially, what Big Bang theorists do is that they'll take certain evidence and show how it fits into a Big Bang model under these certain conditions. Because there's a lot of free variables in the Big Bang model. Like, we don't know exactly how the Big Bang allegedly happened. There's certain free variables in the way that it did. So you can always shift these free variables to match a particular piece of evidence. But the problem is that when you're looking at evidence, you're always shifting the variables in a different way. So what Paul did is he took it four major pieces of evidence. I don't know what they are offhand, but he found how good is the fit if you don't change the variables to each separate one. Like a good analogy is, or one analogy is, say you have a carpet that you're trying to use to cover a floor and the carpet isn't big enough, but you can always shove it into each corner. You can shove it in one corner and shows that it covers it. Go to another corner, move the carpet and shove it in that corner. You can do it to all four corners and show that it covers all four corners. Therefore, it must cover the whole room. But obviously that's ridiculous. But that's pretty much what, if you look at evidence in isolation and adjust the Big Bang parameters to that, that's essentially what you're doing. So he said, well, what are the best parameters to cover all four without changing the parameters, and compare that to his model of continuous creation based on subquantum kinetics. And he actually showed that it fits his model better. That was, once it was published, it was well received.
And something else in the model, you just mentioned continuous creation, and we're talking about how fundamental particles are always taking in etheric substance to renew themselves consistently, the same way we take in stuff from our environment to renew ourselves. Right. And it's very much in line with that Gnostic idea, as above, so below, because when you're talking about planets, Paul has actually like mapped a very interesting spectrum of the planets where they seem to be outputting more energy than makes sense. So they almost seem like transducers of ether to, again, like produce quote unquote free energy. Now, I don't know if we know how to harness that yet, but at the same time, it seems to be a hint that that's a genuinely possible phenomenon.
Yeah. And just to speak to that briefly, it is the fact that planets emit a certain type of, like, that emit energy. And the mainstream explanation for that is that this is heat left over from the formation of the solar system. However, he plotted this on the line of mass versus luminosity, and the luminosity being one way to measure this energy that's given off by these planets, and plotted it on the same graph with a certain large class of stars, because stars themselves also give off energy that is unaccounted for just from the nuclear reactions. Cause it's known that, you know, there are fusion reactions that go on in, say, our sun, where, you know, hydrogen combines to form helium. And this does give off energy, but it doesn't account for all the energy that we actually observe. So there's this other mystery energy. So he's taken that extra luminosity and plotted it on the same line or on the same graph, and found that they actually line up on the same line, which is remarkable. I mean, no one's ever even thought to do that. Like, why would you plot this energy given off by planets and even compare that to stars? But his, I would call it perhaps a theory, that it's what he has termed genic energy that comes from this subquantum kinetics reaction, that basically matter begets matter. So, and the more matter you have, the more matter it produces. And so you have this exponential relationship. And this is how the galaxy actually formed, according to this. So the universe is actually, you know, closer to a trillion years old, or at least a trillion, let's just say. And that the galaxy formed from a central core, maybe even just one single soliton, that then through time produced another soliton, and then eventually through billions of years grew out into this. So it looks like a Big Bang, but it is just actually one part of this continuous creation that's taking place.
It's almost more like a flower blooming than something exploding, right?
Yes, exactly, yeah.
And again, maybe we can just make a quick little transition here and we'll talk about this as long as you are willing to, but this idea of genic energy and these planets, these huge, I guess, material objects, they're spinning, they're moving, there's all this dynamic qualities to them. But again, there's just this, there's also a stillness to the planets and they're able to take in this mysterious quote unquote energy and possibly put out more than they're taking in. And then we can maybe tether that to the idea of the pyramids, the Egyptian pyramids, and what exactly were those being used for? And there's all sorts of theories. The most obvious is, oh, these were tombs, because yes, we have found bodies in some of them, but definitely not all of them. And the dating and what have you doesn't necessarily support the theory that all of them were for that purpose, or that was even the original purpose. That might have been a later thing where the tradition was lost and they just started burying bodies there. Anyway, so we're left over with two other options. One is that they are meditation chambers, which is totally in line with someone like Richard Merrick, who I've interviewed before, who, again, he is all about the science of sacred spaces and why are they built to certain proportions and how does that alter human states of consciousness? And then the second option is someone like Christopher Dunn, who wrote the book Giza Power Plant, who says, hey, these things were giant transducers of energy. They used a certain process of hydrogen and also, again, maybe transducing some of this genic energy to produce this sort of really intense energetic event within the structure. And then that was able to fuel whatever other maybe quote unquote alien technologies they had or whatever they were working with. So this idea of shape power, I mean, that's kind of a meme in the alternative science research community, and other people would call it the pseudoscientific community. But there's these ideas about, again, these geometries are able to be these kind of vortex points or these convergence points for the ether, the same way that planets are maybe the convergence points for the ether. And I know you've looked into pyramids a bit, and I know you don't have all that much to say on it, but at the same time, what you do have to say, I think, is fascinating. And so maybe you can kind of run with that idea a little bit.
I come at it from the angle of the law of one, also referred to as the raw material. That's something I could talk for many of these interviews on, but to try to stick to the topic of the pyramids, this may be seen as, I can understand how this is seen as pseudoscience. Let me just say, when I talk about this, it's speculative.
Sure.
I don't want anyone to confuse my speculations on what's going on with the pyramid is at the same level of rigor that, say, my work in subquantum kinetics or anything like this. So that these, right. I think these are, you know, these are vastly different arenas. And it's unfortunate that mainstream scientists, you know, if they choose a career of science, that they cannot even publicly talk about their speculations into metaphysics, say. Otherwise, mm-hmm. they'll be ostracized. So it's something that interests me a lot. It's actually the practical applications of it have been in my day-to-day life, in my relationships with people, whether it's, you know, close family members, intimate relationships or friends, that applying, say, the principles of that we might find in the Tarot are ultimately to assist our own spiritual evolution. And part of our spiritual evolution is our relationships with people and things in our day-to-day lives, basically how we approach any human scenario. And so this is really, you might say, the practical application of these types of considerations. And I might even say at a personal level, this is even perhaps more important than the abstract science, because I think the whole purpose of our incarnation is for spiritual growth. So anyways, I want to come at it from that angle, that this is a primary motivation as to what has gotten me interested in what's called the raw material and what has then kind of spilled over into these other, you might say, curiosities of, because Ra does speak about the dimensions of the pyramids, how they are used, how one can use them as a tool for spiritual evolution by making use of the flow of energy within them. And I would say this is probably connected with, you know, similar ideas from yoga or the yogis that you've been talking about. Because energetically, like, you know, to clear our chakras are energy nodal points. And so, you know, there's that connection with the pyramids and how we can use pyramid technology in this way to heal and balance ourselves. But it should be kept in mind that it's ultimately a tool. It's a means to an end. I think the danger, and this has actually happened historically, and this is something that Ra has, you might say, warned about, that we should never put the technology above what it was ultimately meant for, which is to assist in our spiritual evolution and to be of service to each other.
On the forum, you created those diagrams of, again, how the energy flows, their convergence points, and then what happens to that convergence points? What is the point of funneling this energy, this flow? How are we channeling? What are we using it for? Or what were they using it for?
Yeah. So within the Great Pyramid of Giza, that's the largest of the three pyramids that we find on the Giza Plateau in Egypt, which Ra claims to have had a hand in creating and building. There are two chambers, and these have been referred to as the Queen's Chamber, which is the lower chamber, and then the King's Chamber that has the famous sarcophagus in it. And Ra has added that these labels of the Queen's and King's Chamber are certainly not Ra's. That was never the intention. In fact, it was never intended to be exclusively for royalty, even though that seems to have been what it was for. It was, according to the raw material, basically the pyramids have, at a minimum, it's a multi-purpose tool, and three applications of it in particular, and which are not limited to just these three, but the three ones that Ra has spoken about is initiation, healing, and planetary balancing. And so initiation is used to, I guess, for the what's called the spiritual adept to essentially clear out and balance their chakras so that they can tap what's called intelligent energy or intelligent infinity. That's how Ra speaks about it. I would only be speculating as precisely what these are. Maybe this is similar to what the ancient Chinese Taoists masters have been able to maybe harness qi, that there's these other forms of energy around us. Some call it prana, you know, Japanese call it qi, Chinese call it qi, that are able to use this for various applications, one of which is healing. But in order to get to this state, one has to go through a certain type of initiation. And maybe the Chinese, you know, do it just through years of meditation, but that seemed like Ra helped develop this. The pyramid tool can help accelerate this process. And so the Queen's Chamber may actually be more appropriately referred to as the initiation chamber. This is used for initiation. The second application of healing, for using the pyramid as a healing tool, Ra describes that the one to be healed is placed into the King's Chamber, and then it always requires a healer that is placed into the Queen's Chamber, and they help, you might say, direct the energy. So to speak about the flow of energy, that at least the way that Ra describes it, he describes it as there's actually two spirals. And in fact, he calls the pyramid like a scoop. So just from the shape of it, it attracts the prana that's everywhere around us, but it seems to give it structure so that it's a spiraling energy that enters up through the bottom, goes to a nodal point at around the Queen's Chamber, perhaps a bit above it. And then it spreads out again as it goes up like a flame, and then peaks again at the peak, at the apex of the pyramid, and then continues to spiral outward and up from there. So one curious thing about the King's Chamber is that it's offset from the vertical. So it's above the Queen's Chamber, but offset from the center. And he says that this is done purposely so that the second spiral that is coming out of the Queen's Chamber, it's a bit like maybe the analogy I might make is that if you're standing in the middle of a hurricane or a tornado, you don't feel it. You want to actually be offset so that you have the energy of the vortex moving through you. And so this is why the King's Chamber is offset, so that you can get the rush, for lack of a better term, of the spiraling energy. So as far as the placement, and to address, okay, so this, some of the, this geometry work that I've had an opportunity due to the recent Yuletide holiday is there's an interesting description of the location of the Queen's Chamber. And I'm going to pull that up very quickly right here. It's in session 4 of the raw material. So the raw material is all a series of questions and answers. So I'll go ahead and just read this right now. This took place January 22nd, 1981. And so Carla is in trance, who's channeling Ra, and Don is the physicist questioner, and he asks the question, does the shape of the pyramid have effect upon the initiation? Ra responds, I am Ra. As we began the last session question, you have already recorded in your individual memory complex the first use of the shape having to do with the body complex initiation. He's referring to the pyramid. the initiation of spirit was a more carefully designed type of initiation as regards the time-space ratios about which the entity to be initiated found itself. Okay, so the next sentence is the description of the geometry. So he says, if you will picture with me the side of the so-called pyramid shape and mentally imagine this triangle cut into four equal triangles, you will find the intersection of the triangle, which is at the first level on each of the four sides, forms a diamond in a plane which is horizontal. The middle of this plane is the appropriate place for the intersection of the energies streaming from the infinite dimensions and the mind-body-spirit complexes of various interwoven energy fields. Thus it was designed that the one to be initiated would, by mind, be able to perceive and then channel this, shall we say, gateway to intelligent infinity. This, then, was the second point of designing this specific shape. So a number of people through the years, I guess, have been speculating on or proposing different ideas as to what he meant about this as, you know, mentally imagine the triangle being cut into four equal triangles and then find the intersection of the triangle. So it's certainly not clear as to what he's saying, at least from the perspective of our 3D minds, let's say. So actually in the past couple of weeks, I used Mathematica. So I was wondering, if you can imagine each side of the triangle and you cut it into four equal slices, right? So if you're imagining approximately equilateral triangle, the Great Pyramid of Giza is not consisted of equilateral triangles, but it's for the purpose of just visualizing in one's mind, it's fair enough. It's certainly an isosceles triangle. So you cut it into four equal triangles. I imagine you'll probably have this linked up on the interview.
Yep.
Okay. So then you'll have a central triangle that's pointing downward. It's the main triangle, if you imagine the base, the bottom flat pointing upward, and you cut it into four equal triangles, you'll have the center triangle pointing downward. Okay. So then if you imagine looking straight through into the pyramid through the center triangle, you can be looking through just this section of space that just passes through the bottom of the pyramid. But if you imagine looking at all four sides of the pyramid in exactly the same way, there's going to be an intersection of the site, and it actually forms a 12-sided convex polyhedron that is actually in the shape of a diamond, surprisingly. And I was actually surprised. I was just wondering what does he mean by this? It forms a diamond. So I went to images.google.com and just typed in diamond. And then I saw it. It was like more or less the same shape that is this intersection. And it's very low. I used to think, as well as other people on the raw material forum, thought that it was this square at the center height or at the middle height of the pyramid that is halfway up. But this is very far from the Queen's Chamber. The Queen's Chamber physically in the real pyramid is actually very low, close to the base. So that wasn't matching up. But when I matched up this diamond that was actually formed, it, for all effective purposes, precisely matched up with the peak of the Queen's Chamber. And I was very surprised about that. I was pleasantly surprised. And so I'm fairly certain this is what Ra had in mind. Because we have to, I guess, remember that Ra himself is a six-density beings, or, you know, six-dimensional. They often switch the words dimensional and density, but he's not looking at our 3D space the same way that we are. Like any time that we look at something, you know, within the space, we have a certain perspective. But if we're outside of the space, in the same way that, you know, if we're standing outside of a 2D space that a character is in, we can see every single point in the space, just like we're looking at a picture, right? But a two-dimensional person living within that space can't see beyond the walls of their own room. And even then, they can only look at one wall at a time. So when you're outside of the space, it's completely different. And so Ra gives a clue within this answer. He says, if you will picture with me. So how do we picture with him? How do we picture with an entity that is outside of the space? So this is, I think it's much more natural then that we're actually looking at all four sides simultaneously and able to directly see its intersection. And that is this diamond shape. And so that was the only geometric, because I've always wondered, like, why are the King's Chamber and the Queen's Chamber placed in these particular locations? Why is the Queen's Chamber so low? And this was the first, you might say, geometrically compelling description or reasoning that I had found within the raw material.
And I mean, obviously this is quote unquote speculative, but at the same time,
right,
if even some of this is true, what this points to again is a very high level of sophistication on the part of the builders. And the question is, where did all that knowledge come from? And the raw material might point us in that direction. It's like, well, you know, people are able to channel whatever, the infinite, and some people call it God, some people just call it nature, other people call it ether. I don't know. It's a subjective thing. You can call it whatever you want. But the question is, where did that knowledge come from? That's truly amazing. Some people might say, well, aliens landed in their ships and told us. But I don't know. Based on what we know about human consciousness and how we're able to channel these other dimensions or whatever, it seems like maybe we're just pulling it from another shamanic realm like shamans have been doing forever.
Yeah.
So it's really fascinating to see it again, like someone accepting the possibility. Again, it's like we're speculating, and yeah, it's not, we're not saying this is truth. You decide for yourself what your truth is. But at the same time, right, I think it's worthwhile to definitely take these ideas, say, hey, this is interesting. Then what can I take my tool set and then apply to it and synthesize it? So you have all this background in computer science and modeling, and you're able to create these really interesting diagrams and pull these things together in ways that other people could never do. Because again, we all come at this from different angles and we all bring our own backgrounds into it. And it's like, what gifts can we bring to bear on figuring out the mystery of it all? And even if we don't necessarily figure out the mystery, it's like you said, it's spiritual development, even if you don't reach the destination itself, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's just fascinating to see maybe how pyramids work and maybe what they're used for and the dynamics of that. And why not? It's worth thinking about. It heightens our consciousness. It makes us think outside the box. It's all these things. And seeing your diagrams, it's like, I was just blown away just seeing that anyone would even try this. I've never seen anything like this. It's very, you know, you bring a sophistication to these topics that a lot of people don't or would like to, but just aren't able to. And it's a bold thing to say, hey, I'm going to use my tool set and just kind of have some fun with it. Cause it is fun, you know, it brings joy to your life to say, hey, maybe there's more than just waking up in the morning in this materialist world that we find ourselves in, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So
yeah, no, that's
a good way to wrap it up. Questions.
I guess in closing, maybe you can give us an idea of any projects you're working on or where people can, you know, find more information on you. Obviously, we've collaborated on a website together, so maybe we want to mention that, but I'll leave it to you.
Yeah, and I want to thank you for the amount of momentum that you've added to the Blue Science site. I mean, it certainly wouldn't have gotten as far as it has been without your help.
Yeah.
So I really want to thank you for that, John. So anyone wants to go there, it's blue-science.org, blue science separated by a dash.org. I've kind of been on vacation. I'm looking at my next career move. I might be headed back into Wall Street. But as far as the science, actually, I'm very intrigued by general relativity and the rotating disc. It's been there from the very beginning, even before the formation of general relativity, but it hasn't been fully explored. And it may even, when it's explored fully, it may even lead into the Nazi Bell experiment, because you get some very weird, interesting effects when you start taking into, you know, relativity into what's actually going on, a spinning disc of high rotational velocity. So maybe that's something that might come out another time. I may try to do some animations with that, but that's it for now, I think.
Matt, thank you for being on the show today.
Okay. Thanks so much, John.